The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lord's Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of the James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio on DAB Digital, online, or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
A slightly curious set of circumstances in the cricket because, of course, this is India's first game of the World Cup. South Africa, meanwhile, are already a week into their World Cup campaign, and frankly, it might be over because they have already lost. They lost to England on the opening day, they lost to Bangladesh, and they are now staring down the barrel of defeat to second favourite India. But why has this sort of schedule emerged? It is curious, isn't it? Because South Africa are literally a week ahead of India in the World Cup. This might be the end for them, and for India, it's just the beginning. It's bizarre, or certainly I think to an outsider, it would look pretty bizarre that India have been given an extra week, it would seem, to prepare for the tournament. Why? Why have they had this extra week to prepare for a Cricket World Cup? A Cricket World Cup where, realistically, it's supposed to be even across all the teams. It's not necessarily at a neutral venue, but it's kind of neutral unless you're the home team, and that just happens, doesn't it? Well, I'll tell you why. If ever there was a demonstration of the two great powers that rule cricket, money and India, this is it. It comes down to a little-known body called the Lodha Committee. L-O-D-H-A, the Lodha Committee. You've probably never heard of them, and I have to admit I'd forgotten about them, because they were convened 7 years ago by the Supreme Court in India to deal with a match-fixing scandal which broke in the IPL. A match-fixing, spot-fixing, all sorts of allegations of corruption. And this committee came in to conduct a review into it and make sure that you basically never have it again. It never happens again, because it was so damaging for the IPL, cricket's most expensive and most successful tournament. Now, this committee brought in lots of different regulations, cooling off periods for officials, various break clauses, all sorts of things affecting the conditions under which cricket is played. And one of those regulations was to allow, or ensure, I should say, a 15-day break between the end of the IPL and the upcoming international fixtures, i.e. the Indian international fixtures, so that Indian players didn't have to go straight from the IPL into playing for India. I think there's a concept that the more you tire players out or put them through that, the more vulnerable they are to corruption. I'm not sure of the exact logic behind it, but it's one of these regulations under which Indian players now play. Now, initial schedules had the IPL final on May the 19th, and India's opening game of the World Cup on June the 2nd. Now, you may not need to be a genius to work out that those two things are more or less than 15 days between them. So things had to change. And actually, kind of remarkably, both sides ended up changing. Because the IPL ended up moving a week earlier, and the ICC moved the Cricket World Cup match for India a week later, or as it is, 3 or 4 days later. Now, that in itself is surprising because it's not often that the ICC compromise. But you know what that does do? It gives India the longest possible time to prepare for the Cricket World Cup. How on earth have the ICC found it in themselves to be so generous, so very, very generous, to allow them all this time? Is it fair? It's absolutely not fair, by the way. Of course it's not fair. It's outrageous. Today's match, by the way, between India and South Africa features Quentin de Kock, who played in the IPL final, Faf du Plessis, who played in the IPL final, and Imran Tahir, who played in the IPL final. The Indian Premier League is not an India-only competition. And yes, lots of the India team played in that IPL final as well, but they were given an extra week off. South Africa have had 3 games of cricket three games of international cricket in the time that India have had just one. How is this fair that these players, you know, basically what the ICC are saying is, yes, we care about player welfare as long as you're from India. Yeah, we care about whether cricketers are playing too much or too little as long as they're from India. So India are basically too powerful here. That's what's going on. They are too powerful in the ICC. The money from the IPL is too much for cricket's governing body to turn their nose up at it and disagree with India. Because realistically, and they're not above this, India could walk away from the World Cup. If they didn't like the schedule or thought that their regulations weren't being put up with or accommodated for, they would have walked away. And what does that do to the World Cup from the ICC's perspective? It would lose them billions, millions, perhaps billions of dollars. And that's what makes the ICC tick. It's not the future of the sport. It's not the promotion of the sport, the development of it. It's cash. Cold, hard cash. And because India generates a lot of that, that's all they're interested in. They're not interested in getting cricket into Central Africa or getting cricket into South America or promoting cricket in Afghanistan or Namibia or Kenya or Algeria. They're only interested in driving more and more revenue through the top teams in world cricket. Sport is supposed to be fair. It's the great leveller, they call it. It's the whole point is that everyone plays on the same playing field and making sure that when that first ball is bowled, it's only about cricket. But it's not, is it? The ICC's Cricket World Cup is not only about cricket. In fact, it's hardly about cricket. Forget the cricket. It's about making sure it's as commercially successful as possible. It's not that important, the cricket. It's more important to sell this to the younger generation, isn't it? To make sure that cricket continues to be commercially successful in the various different countries which the ICC care about, i.e. India and maybe one or two others. So you know what? If you are part of this younger generation that the ICC are trying to capture with this World Cup, if you're the kind of person, probably under the age of 30, who's really getting into cricket thanks to this World Cup, and while I admit it hasn't really caught light yet, it is pretty exciting, and I'm a lifelong cricket fan. But if you're new, and you want to really get involved with cricket, and really you've decided, you know what, this is brilliant, it's exciting, it's fun, the crowds are brilliant, don't go and buy a Pepsi at a Cricket World Cup match. Don't go and buy a hot dog. Don't subscribe to their preferred mobile phone provider or give them your data so you can use their perilously free Wi-Fi. Don't do that. Go down to your local cricket club. Spend some money behind the bar. Buy a Coke or a Pepsi or whatever soft drink you like there because, you know, at your local cricket club, you're allowed to have choice. Whereas in the ICC's Kafka-esque sort of grounds, you're only allowed to drink the prescribed beer, the prescribed cola that you are told to drink. During the Champions Trophy a couple of years ago, they were confiscating Coca-Cola off people at the gate because Pepsi was the preferred drinks partner. What kind of world are we living in where that's more important than promoting cricket around the world? So go down your club and buy whatever you want to buy. Put some money in their coffers. Pay your membership fees. Go and watch your local county team. Make cricket work for us. Don't make it work for the ICC.
Love sport.
Now we're getting very much to the sharp end of the French Open, and who better to speak to at the sharp end of any tennis tournament than Charlie Eccleshare, journalist at The Telegraph, who joins us now. Charlie, a great 2 weeks already for Joanna Konta. She threw to the semi-finals. I think for all her good form on clay this year, did anyone really see this coming?
No, I don't think so. To get to the semis, having, you know, she never won a match before at Roland Garros, so I think, you know, people were thinking, yeah, she's played well and maybe third round, fourth round would be a decent return. I think for her to get to the semis and, you know, beating a player like Sloane Stephens like she did has far exceeded everyone bar the most optimistic of supporters.
Is there a sense that something has changed about Joanna Konta's game? You know, I watched the Sloane Stephens match because it didn't take up much of my day in the end. And she hit the ball so cleanly for such an extended period of time. But equally, I've watched enough Joanna Konta to know that that's kind of her game. She plays lights out tennis and some days it really comes off. Is there anything she's adjusted to improve herself on clay?
Well, she's trying to play with a bit more variety. And that's something that her new coach has been instilling in her. her previous coach, Michael Joyce, was all about aggression and sort of, you know, just trying to build up that contest strength. Whereas now it's a bit more about playing with a bit more variety, a few more drop shots, not just that all-out attack. Because the problem Konta has traditionally had is that she has a bit of a ceiling. She has a brilliant plan A, but not so much of a plan B. Now watching her here, she plays with some spins. She lures people in. She's a lot more comfortable at net. That was an issue before, that if you got Konta towards the net, she would struggle. And even on the serve, if you look, she's varying it a bit more. She's not always going for the all-out pace, but she's finding the corners. She's producing some kick serves at key moments. So it's these little alterations that have made a big difference for her, because she, as you say, she's always had that ability to, on her day, be anyone. It's just about having that consistency. And if that plan A isn't working, then what else has she got? And now she has plenty else, and that's made a big difference for her.
She's going to encounter Markéta Vondrousova, the Czech teenager, in the semi-final. A left-hander. That's, I've pretty much got through all I know about her already, Charlie. Can you tell us any more?
Well, if you like drop shots, you'll love Vondrousova. She's an absolute master at that. So she'll do that with Joe. She'll try and lure her in and then, you know, get herself set up for lobs or to just stick away a volley. She's only 19. She won her first WTA tournament she entered, she won as a 17-year-old. So that gives you an idea of her precociousness. Extremely talented. And actually, had she not had injuries last year, she might have sort of made this breakthrough even earlier than she has done. She's 19. She's inside the top 40. She's not quite seeded. Bags of talent. One thing that might give Joe a bit of encouragement, aside from the fact she's playing an unseeded player in the semi-final and how great an opportunity is that, is the fact that yesterday she was tight as a drum trying to close out her quarter-final match. She served for it, had a match point, double faulted on it, and honestly looked like she could barely hold the racket. So hopefully Joe will be thinking, you know, she can prey on some of those nerves. But she's super talented. She's beaten Halep already a couple of times this year, including on clay. The pair met actually in Rome a few weeks ago, but it was on that slightly crazy day when everyone had to play two matches and Vondrousova was pretty knackered by the end. But Konta won that 6-1 in the third, so good omens there. You know, Konta is the favourite. There's no two ways about it, but it certainly won't be easy. But, you know, if Konta brings her A game, I don't think there's anyone that can stop her at the moment. She's just too good, too powerful.
Yeah, she's certainly been saying that herself as well. Across in the men's draw is, of course, the day for the second lot of quarterfinals because of the way the French Open schedule works. Djokovic-Zverev looks like the best match, obviously. How impressed have you been with how Djokovic has played this week and last week, for that matter?
Yeah, extremely. I mean, so much so that his matches have been pretty dull because a number of opponents have gotten near him. He's looking really, really good. I actually would say over their matches so far, I'd put him slightly above Nadal just for pure consistency, you know, no let up. Nadal has dropped a set, and you know, we're talking ridiculously high standards here, but, you know, Nadal's dropped a set. At times, his level's dipped a bit. Djokovic has had very few dips. He looks completely in control. And so it appears as if we're heading towards a Djokovic-Nadal final, which would be an unbelievable prospect. But today, hopefully, Sasha Zverev will be a step up because Djokovic has benefited from a fairly kind draw. And today will be a lot more challenging, I would have thought.
But we can't get away from the fact that on Friday we've got the showpiece match, isn't it? It's Federer and Nadal. It's obviously on clay, which they've not done in a long, long time. How does this matchup map out? Obviously, Nadal, I think he's a 13-2 winner in their head-to-head on clay. But how is this match going to differ maybe from previous meetings on this service?
Well, I think the big thing is that Federer's backhand is far, far better than it was in all of those meetings. And, you know, they haven't met on clay since 2011. Federer's completely remodeled his backhand then. And if you watch those old matches, it followed a pattern of Nadal fizzing topspin forehands up to about shoulder height and Federer's backhand and him not being able to cope with it. Yeah. He should be able to deal with that better now. He takes it earlier, so he'll be taking it on the rise. And that was a big thing when Federer beat Nadal in the 2017 Australian Open final. And he's won the last five meetings. So, you know, he will have that confidence. He might, you know, try and play tricks on himself and just not remember those previous clay court matches. They were so long ago. But that's going to be a big thing. If Federer's backhand can stand up to that barrage of high spun cross-court forehands from Nadal, then he's got a chance.
how much of a chance, how big a favourite is Rafael Nadal for this? Because obviously this is Rafa's second home at Roland Garros. It might even be his first home these days. He spent a little time in Spain, frankly. How big a favourite is he still, despite all of those improvements Federer's made?
I think you'd still give Nadal the edge. And for me, the smart money would be a Nadal in four sets. But it's certainly not going to be, I don't think it will be like one of those demolition jobs that Nadal has put on Federer before. I mean, 2008 final, Nadal lost four games to Federer. I mean, that's just in the final, that's just ludicrous. 3-1 in love. So, you know, I don't think we'll have something like that. That said, sometimes Nadal, you know, relishes this opportunity to step up on clay and say, you're in my turf now, get out of here. So maybe we'll see him kind of raise his level. But yeah, for me, I think it'll be Nadal in four.
Where does this clay comeback, you know, sit for you in Federer's career? Because I remember when he first said, oh, I'm going to come back to clay, I had already decided I was never going to see Roger play on clay again. Were you surprised by it? And do you think he's achieving what he wanted to achieve?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I didn't really see why he would change the formula, though. I suppose for him, the formula stopped being a winning one last year when he went out of the Wimbledon quarterfinal against Kevin Anderson and said he felt a little undercooked. So there's obviously a logic there. But yeah, at 37, nearly 38, it did surprise me. And you know what? It just speaks to Federer's consistency, which is one of the things that's maybe overlooked with him because it's a less glamorous attribute than all his other ones. But, you know, he just delivers again and again and again. And over such a long period of time, he will almost always get the quarterfinals of majors, admittedly not the previous two. But, you know, he just delivers on that way. And so him, you know, him getting to the semi, I suppose it shouldn't surprise us too much because when he's there and playing a tournament and focused, he almost always delivers.
Charlie Eccleshare there, tennis journalist for The Telegraph, ahead of a brilliant climax coming up to the French Open. Federer Nadal on Friday, Djokovic Zverev today, and Konta, of course, going for a first place in the French Open final tomorrow as well.
Love Sport.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Joshua says he's had no excuses, that he's finally come out and spoken. He did do post-fight press conferences, but I think he was pretty discombobulated and pretty frazzled. He didn't see himself. I was actually pretty disappointed that we didn't see him rushed off for medical treatment. I don't think he should have been doing those interviews after the fight. He wasn't right. That was very clear. I've also got some big shocking news from the boxing world. Deontay Wilder's been talking. Yeah, I know. It's crazy, really. Such a mild-mannered bloke. Softly spoken, reserved individual, normally. He's broken his silence on Anthony Joshua's defeat. I was actually surprised not to see Wilder ringside on Saturday night. He's done it before. He didn't turn up for the Joshua Parker fight in Cardiff, but obviously, the other side of the Atlantic, you kind of understand it. But when your main rival comes to your country and makes his debut to make a statement, surely you go. Surely you go and watch and try and make it a bit about you. I don't know. Anyway, I'm not sure what his reaction would have been to that defeat, but he's now talking, and not for the first time. He's talking about Eddie Hearn. He's actually a little bit right. He's also a lot wrong, but he stumbles across a little bit of truth. He says, Joshua will never talk for himself. Hearn's put so much pressure on him, sold him a lot of emotional garbage, put a lot of things that weren't true, and also a lot of pressure. So Joshua had to not only come out and say certain things and back up his words, but he also had to back up his promoter's words as well. I don't think that was fair for him. Where Wilder is right is that there was pressure on Joshua and that it affected the fight. I don't think it affected him psychologically. I think it affected him tactically because he went in, he floored the reason, he thought, right, I've got to finish it now. I've got to get this big knockout. That's why I'm here. I'm here in America to knock a man out in spectacular fashion and make my name. And it was a mistake. And Ruiz caught him. And once he caught that really great shot to the temple, that was that. Much as he lasted another four rounds, I think that was the end of it. So, yeah, Wilder is partly right. He's not right about Eddie Hearn. That Joshua never talks for himself. We've literally just heard Joshua talk for himself. So he's completely wrong on that front anyway. And I don't think that Hearn sells Joshua the wrong way or anything like that. I do think there are issues in the promotional side. Wilder also said, I told Hearn you are milking him and everything I said has come true to this point. It was 100% mental, so much pressure on him. Fans want to see me and him fight, and that is a big thing. The milking line I don't like. And he's used the word slave as well, which obviously has a lot of problematic connotations, not to mention the overall, you know, unfairness of that comment. But on the milking side, I understand what he means. And coincidentally, he's right to a very, very narrow extent, which is that the promotional machine behind Joshua knows that they have to take the big fights at the right time, or at least that's what they think, because they know that a defeat can be so damaging. So they don't want to take risks. Sportsmen don't mind taking risks because they always believe that they are going to survive the risk. It's what you have to do when you walk into a boxing ring. It's believe that you are going to survive the risk you're taking. The risk and reward, you've already worked it out. You're fully committed. And in business, people don't like being in a two-way matchup and only on one side. You'd much rather be the bloke who owns the ring and the stadium, who gets paid every time, no matter what, over and over again, than the bloke who owns the race course, or the bloke who has 15% of a boxer on one side of a fight. You'd always rather have much less risk. So in that sense, there are slightly different agendas between what Wilder sees as Joshua's endgame, which is just being aggressive and being someone who goes out and wins titles and wins fights, and the other side, which is trying to make sure he maximises his potential commercially. Wilder was also quick to point out, by the way, my last fight, I delivered what I always deliver, a devastating knockout. That was a lot of pressure. Giving himself a bit of credit for Andy Ruiz Jr.'s defeat of Joshua. He also said, I heard Joshua got knocked out in sparring. His dad didn't want him to fight, but Hearns being Hearns are greedy. They've got to keep the generational wealth for their family, and there was a lot at stake. Now, that last bit, I mean, Deontay has really rustled around the kitchen drawer and found his tin hat there, because that is proper mad. It's the kind of conspiracy theories that some fans, so-called fans, and moronic Twitter accounts calling themselves connoisseurs of boxing and things have been circulating for a couple of days. It's bad enough that we've got an American conspiracy theorist in the UK being wined and dined by the royal family. Can we try and keep it out of the sport of boxing as well, please? I don't need that.
Love sport.
Joe Conta will hopefully get underway on time in her semi-final tomorrow. Let's speak to someone who knows all about tennis. Alan Jones, tennis coach, is on the line. He, of course, used to work with Joe Jury, who was the last British woman to reach the French Open semi-finals. Alan, I'm delighted to have you on the show. How excited are you to see a British woman back in the late stages of a French Open once again?
Well, it's wonderful, and B, it's a long time coming. And, you know, one of the funny things I know people have said to Joe, you must be so upset. She said, far from it. I'm delighted. Isn't it great that someone else can now, we can start look forward to, that we already know she can play, what she did 2 years ago. But history has shown that she doesn't like clay. And here she is, right at the doorstep of maybe getting to the final.
As you say, she traditionally doesn't like clay. And though actually, I have sat in press conferences and those questions have come. And she goes, well, you all say I can't play on clay, but I think I can. She is now.
I didn't say that. I said traditionally she didn't like clay.
No, well,
it
true.
Liking it as, yeah.
Exactly. But she'd never won a match at the French. So it was hard to believe her when she said that. Do you think that she will have made many changes to her game to try and make it work on clay, or that this was just something that was waiting to happen?
Watching the matches that I've seen and what she was doing before getting to the semi-final in the other events she's played, she seems more composed. She seems more at ease with her traditional game of strike. You know, when you think of the points and return of her own serve yesterday, when you've got that pretty much a service weapon now, clay isn't just about the grind. If you know when to attack and attack with a degree of confidence, which I think in the last 18 months she's lacked a little bit, it's one of the best ways. Joe attacked on it, Sharapova attacked on it, Serena attacked on it. This idea that it's just for grinders isn't quite true. but you've got to learn how to and when to pull the trigger.
Do you think that perhaps the reason that British players haven't always been good on clay is because they don't have that understanding, because obviously we don't play as much on clay in this country?
Well, if you look at the logic to it all, McEnroe never won Roland Garros. Edberg never won Roland Garros. The list will go on of world-class male players in particular that never won on clay. However, all the male clay quarters in particular, apart from Rafa, don't win any other surface. So if you sacrifice a lot of your game just becoming a clay quarter, it can be dangerous because you can take the edge away from the game you need in other surfaces. And my argument would be Tim and Joe, both against what people would have predicted, both did well in Roland Garros. But they, as with age, learn to be more mature with an attacking game.
How well do you rate Joe Konta's chances in the semi-final and going forward in the final? Obviously, she's playing a little bit unknown.
She's playing somebody she's beaten four times already, I believe. Mm. So you would say that's favourable. But the young lady is a very gifted girl. And she will probably be less nervous than Konta in a funny way, because her journey, she's young and she's experiencing a different type of journey. Joanne Konta is trying to do this quite late in life, and it's going to be a good match. I think if Konta can retain the emotional edge that she's got at the moment, she'll be tough to beat in the semis. In the final, one would assume it's going to be Halep, but you don't know. There's some good players on the other half of the draw. Mm. If Madison Keys is seeing the ball well, she can hit winners all over the place. So, yeah. Fingers crossed.
That would be a heck of a final as well. Konta, Madison Keys, you wouldn't be short of winners in that game. I wanted to just take you back, Alan, if I may, to the last time we had a woman in that semi-final, as I mentioned, with Joe back in 1983. Yep. She obviously took a one-set lead. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about...
It was deeper than that. She had a set and a break.
What went wrong?
Well, first of all, Mimi Jozevic, who she lost to, was by tradition, a damn good clay quarter. Mm. She was an Eastern Bloc young lady, good hand skills, and Joe, for a long passage for a set and a half, was on top of her. Mimi just hung around enough, worked enough balls with drop shots and angles that took away some of the winners that Joe was hitting, and then it became too much of a grind, and before she knew it, the clay quarter got through it. But set and a break up, and playing the way she did, she just needed to keep her foot on the pedal. And the only irony was, the very next tournament she played was at Eastbourne. Mm. First round, draw. She played Mimi Jozevic first round. And because it was grass, Joe won 3-1. And all the pundits are going, this doesn't make sense. And I said, that just shows you know bugger all about tennis, because clay and hold are very different.
What do you rate of, irrespective of how she goes in the next couple of days, what do you think of Joe's chances coming into Wimbledon, playing as she is?
Well, if someone had said to me 5-6 years ago, Joe Konta was going to be able to beat four in the world, what she did at Wimbledon 2 years ago, and at this, I didn't see it. I'll put my hand up and say she's worked hard, she's very disciplined, she knows what she wants. Why not? She clearly has the focus back, and I think has a bit more authority to her game at the moment. That's what it looks like to me. But I'm not a fly on the wall in her camp. So that's what the outside looks like.
Well, always great to have your expert eye on things, Alan. I'm sure you'll be watching closely when Joe takes the court tomorrow. An absolute pleasure to have you on. So Alan Jones there, tennis coach, and he was the man behind Joe Dury when she, of course, was the last British woman to reach a French Open semi-final at Roland Garros. Joe goes tomorrow against Vudrasova, a Czech left-handed teenager. It might look like her best opportunity to reach a Grand Slam final, perhaps ever. We hope there'll be many more.
Love sport.
I just want to talk very briefly about this Gianni Infantino news, because it's not as though Gianni Infantino is the ultimate anti-Blatter. Yeah, that's a sort of joke, that sort of pun. He's very much one of Blatter's blokes, and he was picked to complete the term of Infantino in 2016. And now he's actually been up for election, and no one has even run against him. No one has got the stones, the stomach, to take on Gianni Infantino in an election. Don't tell me it's because he's the perfect president. Don't tell me because there's nothing wrong with Gianni Infantino. I want to know why no one has run against him. in what should be a democratic election in the biggest sport in the world. I tell you, boxing almost got expelled from the Olympics because there was a lack of democracy and accusations of corruption at the top of the AIBA, the International Board of Amateur Boxing. So how on earth have the Olympic Committee not gone, hang on, you had a massive investigation into corruption at FIFA. You sacked the bloke at the top of it, and then his right-hand man took over, and now he's been elected unopposed. How on earth are the International Olympic Committee not looking at that and going, this something doesn't seem right here? How are they not threatening to have soccer eliminated from the Olympics? Because frankly, what does football really add to the Olympics anyway? It's this weird under-23 format with a couple of over... Ryan Giggs played for Team GB, for goodness sake. Like, what on earth is Olympic football? Funnily enough, in the women's game, it's one of the biggest tournaments, and it's great, and it's a brilliant platform for the women's game. But I've always said that Olympic sports should be the pinnacle of that sport. It's why I think it's a farce to have golf in there, because you know the one bloke who really cares about Olympic golf? Justin Rose, because he won it. He brings it up all the time. I'm pretty sure his medal is actually stuck around his neck now. He can't take it off. But no one else really cares. It's not the pinnacle of the sport. And that's why it shouldn't be part of the Olympic sport. What do they call it? A sort of pantheon of sports, I suppose. And it's the same with men's football. So I don't know why the International Olympic Committee can't take the lead on this, because FIFA are massive, they're really powerful, and there aren't many bodies who can stand up to them. But surely the IOC can be one of those people to stand up and say, hang on lads, this doesn't look right, maybe have another go. I don't know, maybe it wouldn't make a difference, but it really makes my blood boil that when I see Gianni Infantino walk into another 4 years at the top of FIFA, despite being Sepp Blatter's absolute best mate. I didn't want to talk about Gianni Infantino today. I want to talk about Maurizio Sarri instead. Because Maurizio Sarri, look, people say he's homesick. The quote really is that Italy calls to me. Honestly, Italy calls to me. You know, the wine is lovely. The food is outstanding. The country itself is beautiful. The people are very friendly indeed. Yeah, Italy calls to me, mate. Maurizio, if you're going, can you book a second ticket so I can come along? Because honestly, it's a lovely place. And, you know, if I moved abroad and went to work in a new place for the first time, I wonder how I would feel if I had a great start to my job, you know, started really well. And I thought, yeah, you know, this job's going all right. I'm at the pinnacle of my career. I've never really been better than this. You know, even when Napoli were at their peak, were they as good as Maurizio Sarri's Chelsea in October? When they were on an unbeaten streak that lasted more than 3 months. He must have thought he was on cloud nine. Ah, this English football lark, it's easy. And then all of a sudden, things started to fall apart. Tottenham beat them. Then Wolves beat them. Then Leicester beat them. And then the boos started coming. Because what happened, I think, was Chelsea fans got to Christmas and they went, hang on, we've still got the same manager. This isn't right. You can't have the same manager at the beginning of the season and at Christmas. What's going on here? Sorry out! Boo! Honestly, that's basically what happened. And so Maurizio Sarri, having thought actually that life might be quite easy in England and that things were rather enjoyable, all of a sudden found himself getting booed for doing very little wrong. He found himself getting ridiculed for... He wasn't even allowed to smoke. They wouldn't even let him smoke on the touchline. No wonder he's homesick. He just wants a fag. It's just so unfair. All right, he got ridiculed, I think very unfairly, because Chelsea were playing decent football, right? For the most part. In fact, almost entirely, they were playing good football. They were, for the first 4 months, winning a lot. They were a successful team. And then things started to go a bit wrong. And yeah, there are blips. In any season, you're going to have blips. And there were some bad ones, I don't deny. Manchester City 6, Chelsea 0, I'm being reminded of. Bournemouth 4, Chelsea 0. And second half of the season, weren't great away from home. But where did Chelsea finish, Mr. Anson? Where did Chelsea finish in the Premier League? Third, right? And he's reminded me that it's third in a very specific way with his fingers. You can work out. They finished third. Did they win a trophy this year? Did they beat Arsenal in a cup final? Yes, yes, yes. Maurizio Sarri has had a pretty darn successful season. Right, Ben, before you write more results on my screen, and tell me that Chelsea lost all but one game away to top six sides this season, which is their worst record under Roman Abramovich, why don't you tell me, if I had come up to you in a dream, right, and I know I feature in your dreams semi-regularly, if I had come up to you and gone, Ben, I will give you third in the Premier League and a Europa League title, would you have taken it, yes or no? Of course you would! And I challenge any Chelsea fan out there to tell me that they wouldn't have taken third in the Premier League and a Europa League title. And also, by the way, half a chance Eden Hazard might stay. I know he's basically leaving, but he did say this might be goodbye. You never know, he might stay. I do not buy that the Stamford Bridge faithful are going to sit there and say, no, we'd rather have played more exciting football and finished fifth and gone out in the quarterfinals. Absolutely not. If you are a football fan, what you want is to win. That's what you sing about every week. You don't sing about, oh, we play exciting football, we're Chelsea Football Club. No, you sing about the titles that you win, the big games that you win, the qualifying for the big tournaments, the going to Juventus away. Chelsea couldn't have dreamed of Juventus away this time last year, and now they can because they're in the Champions League. And if you want to play the tribalism game, they denied Arsenal Champions League football. Surely that's sweet. Surely that is a sweet moment for a Chelsea fan to have already qualified for the Champions League, to win a trophy away from home, and then to stop Arsenal getting back into the Champions League. So if I was Maurizio Sarri, I'd be pretty homesick too, because all he is like a lad who's gone to boarding school and been bullied by all the other boys because he's too good at football and too good in lessons.
Love sports.
I want to talk a little bit about Diego Maradona, because what you may have missed, it's Diego Maradona being Diego Maradona, quite frankly. Manchester United have a new coach. Actually, to be fair, they've had one for a while. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer got the job in March full-time. Originally December, then March full-time. Now, I know that news doesn't travel that fast. I don't know, maybe they don't have Twitter in Argentina or Mexico, where I believe Maradona's working at the moment. But somehow he's missed that news, because it appears the legendary player and now notorious coach has put himself in the running for the United job. He did an interview with 442 magazine, and he said, "If Manchester United need a coach, I'm the man to do it. I know they sell a lot of shirts around the world, but they need to win trophies too. I can do that for them." Great. I mean, that's terrific news for Manchester United, that they've got a bloke who says he can win trophies for them and is willing to do it, and who was one of the great players. So, I mean, that's absolutely terrific news. His managerial record as well is, I mean, it's great, isn't it? I assume he's such a good player, and you know, must have been a half decent manager. What's he won as a manager? Nope. Anyone? No. So he has, by the way, he has managed 103 games. The list of clubs is not great, I'll be honest. Mandillo de Corrientes, Racing, Argentina, the international team, because he was well qualified for that. Then Al Wasi in the United Arab Emirates, Fujairah, also in the United Arab Emirates, and he's now coaching Dorados in the second tier of Mexican football. I'll be honest, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's CV was pretty limited when he got them a United job, but that would probably be a bridge too far, I would suggest. Look, I mean, what's Maradona going to do? Like, what's he going to bring to United? Midfield's a problem, so we thought Diego might rack up Chris Lines from Northampton Town. Probably be quite a handy signing. He'd need a right back, so we've gone for Koke from Levante. Again, you know, they need someone at right back. Probably need a bit of cover at left back. Maradona obviously loves Charlie Daniels. So I also thought we might need a little bit of experience, and he might wheel Zoltan Gira out just to sort of add a bit more experience to that midfield. No? I can see the lawyer sweating in the corner. Seriously, though, Maradona, he doesn't even support United anymore. Like, apparently he used to be a United fan. He said, they used to be my favourite English team for so long. So many great players and a great team under Alex Ferguson. But now I have to say Man City. I know you shouldn't change, but it's because of Kun Aguero. We speak a lot and he plays in a very good team. I'm amazed they still speak, given that Maradona's daughter used to be married to him. And now he's... Weirdly, oh, I hadn't even worked this out. Maradona's daughter, Ana Aguero, got divorced like the year Aguero scored that goal. The famous Aguero goal. That maybe that's what triggered it. That's it. The success was too much for him. Anyway, we thought we'd ask what was on Maradona's to-do list. If we do indeed slip into an alternate universe where he does become Manchester United manager. It would be quite the alternate universe, that's for sure. Obviously, we've already mentioned a couple of signings he might make. Chris Lyons, Koke, Charlie Daniels, Zoltan Gira as well. But we thought we'd look at maybe the systematic changes he could make to the team. I think probably United's biggest problem at the moment is their lack of a director of football. So we thought, scratched our heads a bit and wondered which director of football would want to come in and you know run a club where Diego Maradona was manager. And we thought the first choice of the dog would be Diego Maradona. He's absolutely perfect for the job. He knows the manager very well. He's the only person who can tell the manager what to do and the manager will tolerate. So we think Maradona's first signing will be himself as director of football. The second problem he probably has to look at is Paul Pogba. The ultimate enigma. What is Diego Maradona? Fortunately, we already know what he's going to do with Paul Pogba. He says he doesn't work hard and he'd rather Ander Herrera. So all United now have to do is buy Ander Herrera back. So they're going to offer PSG a pretty large amount of money and then give Herrera a £300,000 a week contract. So that's a good start from old Diego here. Off Fenomeno, starting very well there. Then we have to deal with David De Gea. His contract, obviously, expiring. Diego Maradona's approach to negotiations has sometimes been a little unorthodox. I seem to remember when the Argentinian press were camped outside his house, hoping that he would sign a deal enabling him to play at the 1994 World Cup, he shot at them with an air rifle and got sued by two of them who he hit. So I'm hoping that he won't go round to David De Gea's house and start shooting people. More likely, I can sort of imagine Diego Maradona sending him lots of presents, you know, sort of tightly wrapped parcels around his house and saying, David, we want you to stay. I think that would maybe be his approach. And look, maybe, because I don't know who got the house. So I happen to know where Sergio Aguero used to live in Audley Edge, and it's a lovely place. And if his daughter got the house in the divorce, maybe he could give it to David De Gea and say, look, you move into this street, it's much nicer, Audley Edge is very nice, you move in there. Maybe that'll work. He's also got a deal with Anthony Martial. He fell out with Jose Mourinho because he went to see the birth of his child. What a pig, eh? Anthony Martial misses his pregnant and he leaves work early to go and spend time with his missus having a baby. The absolute cheek of the man. But I was thinking that if Maradona wants to get him back into the fold, he could offer to help on childcare. He'd go, you know what, Anthony, don't worry about it. You go to training. Maradona doesn't like getting up in the mornings anyway. So he could go over, have a bit of a kip on the sofa, make sure nothing went wrong, you know, really help out on the childcare side. He'd be a great role model as well for the young lad. So I think there's something to be said here. And finally, the centre-back issue. Now, Maradona is that enhanced, deranged, that he might think Phil Jones is a Champions League centre-half, I don't know. But surely even he can see the problems United have got at centre-half. He loves City, he's Argentinian. Nicolas Otamendi, get him on the transfer docket for Manchester United.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Oh my gosh.
Put your hands together for new Dr. Pepper Blackberry and Dr. Pepper Blackberry Zero Sugar.
There she is!
Pepper!
With sweet blackberry flavor!
Dr. Pepper Blackberry, I'm obsessed with your succulent taste! Please marry me!
No! Marry me! Marry me, or I'm gonna freak out!
Try new Dr. Pepper Blackberry.
It's a pepper thing!